against JVDB. And you might as well stay at the same tables. Mr. Lewin.
Musical chairs.
It's no more pronounceable this time than it was before.
Yes, Your Honor. Okay, Your Honor, in this case, the district judge found three of the four allegations against JVDB. We are appealing two of those, and we're appealing his denial of a bad faith and harassment finding for the one item and also his damages award. Our first appeal deals with 1692CA3, which talks about calling a person at work when, according to the statute, there's communication at the person's place of employment if and only if the debt collector knew or had reason to know that the consumer's employer prohibited the consumer from receiving this communication. Now, the affidavit.
What does JVDB do to determine which employers do and do not prohibit such calls?
I don't believe they have any procedures. It's basically information.
This is something on which one would think that your client's industry would have itself a database. So they would know whether General Motors, as a corporate policy, permits or prohibits these calls, and so on.
I don't know if
your client is let's say, willfully ignorant of this, too.
I would say that if such a database exists, I'm not familiar with. This is a transport company.
It seemed to me, well, they're separate questions. One is whether such a database exists. It would certainly seem to me in the interest of your client and its industry to have such a database, given the way the statute works. And then one would need to know whether this particular employer had been big enough to be in it.
Right.
But, you know, yet again saying, my client knows, you know, knows nothing, see no evil, hear no evil, speak no evil. It's not a dignified posture.
Again, Your Honor, as I said, the high volume collection, you see this was a dental bill.
Exactly the point. It's a high volume business, and that's why you use lists and databases.
But yeah, I want to move on to another point. I mean, I'm not interested in whether you want to characterize as an afterthought or not, but this lady says that she told Romero I could not talk to him at work and ask him to give me his telephone number so I could call him back from home. Now, your view seems to be that debtors around the country who represent an enormous variety of people only get the benefit of this statutory protection against being called at work if they, you know, respond like a lawyer and give kind of magic words. She didn't say, I don't want to talk to you. She said, I could not talk to you at work, and she offers the home alternative. So it's not like she's shutting the guy off either. In the real world, it seems to me this must be enough to trigger at least an investigation of whether that's that employer's policy. If they can figure out how to call her at work, they can figure out how to call the front office of that employer and say, do you have a policy about your employees talking to outside callers at work, or however you want to phrase it, one phone call. I mean, that once you've been alerted to the fact that this statutory protection may be in place, which it seems to me, in a lay sense, is what this lady was doing, I found your response very demanding of consumers who are suddenly interrupted in the middle of their workday to remember to say, my employer on page 15 of the manual has a policy prohibiting me from taking personal calls at work.
Well, in this case, she made a statement after they talked about payment. I told Romero I could not pay it in full right now. He said I could make two payments. I didn't tell Romero I could not talk to him at work.
Right. Talk to him at work. I'm looking at page 4 of your brief where you quote it. And could not is close enough to saying I'm not permitted to, that it seems to me that second phone call that Mr. Romero found the time to make could have been to the front office of this company to find out whether he, in fact, was entitled to continue with these efforts at the place of employment.
Well, it's a duty that I don't believe is required by statute. I can say is that I suppose that could be interpreted that way, but the statute says if the debt collector knew or had reason to know.
Or had reason to know, and she has said, I cannot talk to you at work. Please call me at home. You know, give me a number. Why isn't that a duty of inquiry, at least? Reason to know.
Well, she might say, I told Merrill that I could not talk to him at work. Maybe she was busy, or maybe she just didn't want to talk to him. Or maybe,
that's why it may not be the same as actual knowledge, but reason to know, reason to look into it further, it's certainly a trigger of some kind.
Again, it's an interpretation. I don't think it rises to that status. She could say, I'm going to get fired if you talk to me. Well, that would be different. Or my employer says I can't get personal calls at work. But she just said I cannot talk to
you. Or if I devote even 5 minutes of time to anything other than the corporate business, that's bribery.
You were here for the preceding case?
I was, yes, and my head began.
Debt collectors.
Yes, I noticed that. I guess it's an interpretation. In my opinion, it doesn't rise to it, and I guess that's... As I said, when I went to law school in the 60s, you got three attorneys in a room, you get 10 opinions. But in my opinion, it doesn't rise to it.
And the question is what this statute is all about, and who is it supposed to operate for, and how perfectly do alleged debtors have to respond to these calls before Congress's policy of saying, you know, don't call people at work becomes operative?
I think that the statute is about harassing, egregious, demeaning behavior.
Second call.
Yeah,
right. Now, see, it depends. It depends on whether or not this second call, after she said something to the effect of, I could not talk to you at work, is egregious, harassing behavior. I mean,
those are two separate things. Even if that had been the first call, if it had been directly to her and he had used language like that, it seems to me pretty clearly abusive language.
If it had been language, yes. I agree. If he had said it to her, I think he was just making an off-the-cuff statement. He was frustrated. She had hung up on it.
The co-employee passed this message along to her 20 minutes after the first call, which the co-worker does. Your opponent says it's the same as leaving it on voicemail. The old-fashioned voicemail, right? You leave a message with another person. There are actually human beings involved.
I think there's more to the statute than that. It has to be, in that situation, involving with a debt collection, this phone call, the second phone call, did not involve debt collection. The magistrate judge so found it was not. And found for summary judgment on
her
behalf.
She made the connection that it was Romero calling, that Romero had this message to give to her. What did she think? That he was inviting her out for a party? I mean, it was...
But she didn't know why he was calling. It could have been a suitor.
Second time? Romero?
No.
Scholl says Romero had called back, and he said dot, dot, dot.
But Scholl didn't know why he was calling.
No, Scholl didn't, but the plaintiff did.
It's like saying a voicemail machine doesn't know why anybody is calling.
Wow.
But if you call a coworker and say, give the message, stop being such a fucking bitch, to X, you have rather abused and insulted X in the same way the voicemail machine abuses and insults X.
Well, it still has to be the natural.
I'm a little surprised that you are even attempting to defend this. I mean, it kind of digs one in deeper.
Well, it has to be the natural consequence of which is to harass, oppress, or abuse any person in connection with the collection of a debt. So, I guess I'm out of time here, so perhaps I could...
You have a minute for rebuttal if you want to sit down.
Just 1 minute left.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, counsel. Mr. Phillips.
Good morning again, Your Honor. All of Your Honors. I think that you've hit on the key, but there's something to highlight here about Section 1692 C, which is the I can't talk at work. Okay? This would have been a violation whether there was a policy or not, because Section 1692C, also applies where you just say, I don't want to talk to you about this debt anymore, regardless of whether I can talk to you now at work or can't or want to talk to you at work. Section 1692CA1 protects a consumer who just says, I don't want to talk to you, period. So whether Ms. Horky, you know, wrapped herself perfectly in reading the statute back to the debt collector who should know the statute, really doesn't save the defendant. In fact, that's what we're here to protect. The statute is to protect the unsophisticated consumer, not someone armed with a lawyer and the Fair Debt Act, such as a debt collector would be able to in training. This would have violated no matter whether it is a policy or not. You know, you're protecting under 1692C from, I don't want to talk, I can't talk because my employer has a policy, and I just don't want to talk to you, period, anymore. I refuse to pay this debt. And, you know, here the consumer did offer a reasonable alternative. Give me a phone number and I'll call you back. Or if your honors feel that somehow they have to do a better job of saying, you know, there's a policy here, that's what the debt collector should have done. Well, what do you mean?
Do we know what Horky's precise words were?
In her affidavit, it says, I can't talk to you at work, I believe. The affidavit would be...
Is that the precise language, I can't talk to you at work?
I believe that's what the affidavit says. It's in the record, Your Honor, and their precise words are something akin to that, I can't talk to you at work. Didn't say, my employer has a policy and I can't talk to you at work. She testified truthfully by affidavit. They didn't controvert that in any way. I think that...
So this quote on page 4 of the appellant's brief, which doesn't have a citation after the quote, is in fact an accurate quote from Horky's affidavit.
Yes, Your Honor, I think it's a fairly accurate quote.
The district court, the magistrate judge's opinion, doesn't have a precise quote at all.
That's correct, Your Honor. But her affidavit is the only source for this testimony, because there was no deposition taken, there's no counter affidavit presented from the debt collector, Mr. Romero. I think that really that another thing that should be highlighted here is they don't contest the third violation, failure to give the validation notice, or in the alternative that they overshadow the validation notice by immediate payment.
Let me go back.
Yes, Your Honor.
Your statement, your quotation, I can't talk to you, differs from the quotation here, that I could not talk to him at work. Right. Okay. Here's the affidavit, and it says, yes, I told Romero that I could not talk to him at work.
Okay. What I'm saying,
her affidavit does not say what exact words were used.
Well, that she's giving her words there. Does she put it forth in a transcript?
No, actually, it's not quoted. I then told Romero that, right? That's a form used to give the substance of what you thought you said rather than what you actually said.
That's what our client said she said. Now, did she say
not
quote,
what she
unquote?
Said she said. There's no quotation in it.
I understand that. In drafting it, we didn't put quotation marks around it. People don't talk in quotation marks.
People write affidavits to give precise statements.
And I think that is a...
Rather than the substance of the statement.
Well, I think that is a...
Because, again, remember this precise statement. The substance may be as good as we can get. Not everybody is John Dean.
I agree. But in this case, Your Honor, regardless of the precise words, my point is, it's covered under Section 1692C. I don't want to talk. I can't talk. There's a policy here that prohibits talking at work.
But for purposes of 1692CA3, I don't want to talk and I can't talk are different statements.
I would agree, Your Honor. I'd agree. Absolutely.
One reason why it's important to know exactly what was said to determine whether it was the former, which is not a statement of employer prohibition, or the latter, which might well be reason to believe employer prohibition.
I think in this case it is employer prohibition, and even if it isn't, it's protected. But the further issue, though, Your Honor, is regardless of anybody's view on 1692C or the 1692B violation, they still violated the law. They,
you argued the alternative ground to the magistrate judge that it was a violation even if she just didn't feel like talking because people are entitled to say, don't bother me anymore?
No, Your Honor, we're urging those grounds as something that's plain from the statute to support the view here in rebuttal to the defendant's argument that somehow there had to be an explicit, my employer has a policy, it's page 14.
Where is the provision in the statute that prohibits calls if the debtor just doesn't want to talk anymore?
Your Honor, that's section 1692C, paren C, where a debt collector must cease communications if at any time the debtor says, I refuse to pay the debt, or
notifies a debt collector in writing that the consumer refuses to pay.
Or that the consumer wishes the debt collector cease further communication.
Yeah. Notifies the debt collector in writing of A or B. Well, this is not notifying anybody in writing of anything.
Well, in this case, the debtor never got notice that it had to be in writing.
No verification letter had gone out?
Well, not from this debt collector. The debt collector's attorney claims to have sent the letter, but Ms. Porky's testimony was, I never got a letter from anybody. And the district court found that the debt collector never sent a verification notice. So there's no way that Ms. Porky could have wrapped herself in that absent an attorney being told, you know, it needs to be in writing. So I think that although there's a writing requirement here, it's excused or should be excused because she was never advised of that. Now, there's a claim of bad faith that the debt collector wants to be found in bad faith because we lost one part of the three counts. I don't think that passes a straight face test for us to be found liable for bad faith. You'd have to have evidence of bad faith and that it was brought for the purpose of harassment. There's absolutely nothing in this record that supports anything like that. We brought the complaint. We won on all three counts. Nominal damages were awarded of $1,350, and I think this record fully supports that award of $1,350 for the debt collector's actions in this matter. If Your Honor, have any further questions, otherwise I'll sit down.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Mr. Phillips.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Anything further, Mr. Lewin?
I didn't get a chance to cover the bad faith part. I believe that my citations indicate that an attorney, especially an experienced attorney, as the court has seen, should not have brought that particular section that the debt was discussed when all that happened was Mr. Romero, the debt collector's representative, called and the number that was picked up, the phone that was picked up was Ms. Horky's phone and the debt was not discussed. The reason that these allegations are brought are to stack, and if you read the decision, it says there's three violations, therefore I'm going to increase the award. It also gives the attorneys the ability to enhance their fees. You don't have to have any intentional bad faith. An attorney should have known. I mean, even a high school English students could have read that affidavit of Ms. Scholes and known that there was no discussion of the debt and a telephone conversation with her, and I believe my time has expired. Thank you very much.
Thank you, counsel. The case will be taken under advisement.